Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago. He later served as station manager and was one of the morning show hosts.
Tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, you can view a really powerful and fascinating documentary on the series American Experience. The program is called Blackout, and it tells in quite vivid fashion the story of Wednesday, July 13th, 1977, when New York City, all five boroughs, descended into darkness, courtesy of an unexpected power outage, which left, in essence, 7 million people without power and under quite adverse circumstances. It was already a sweltering hot day. A lot of conditions in New York City were already, in a sense, at the boiling point, all kinds of different tensions sort of roiling through the city. And this blackout unleashed a wave of violence and vandalism, which was truly shocking. Some of us are old enough to maybe remember this event, but very likely don't remember many, if any, of the details. Nor do we necessarily have at the time a full sense of context about why the things happened that happened. And of course, some sociologists and historians are still kind of wrestling with the reality of what occurred with this massive blackout. American Experience, as always, has done a very thorough job of telling this important story. And I'm speaking for the next few minutes with Sharon Grimberg, who has been working in public television for nearly two decades and is a senior producer of American Experience and has had her hand in a number of different award-winning films for that and other series. And I'm very, very excited about the opportunity to speak with her about this role for which this documentary for which she served as writer, again called Blackout. Sharon Grimberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Greg.
Remind our listeners, particularly maybe those not old enough to have remembered this great blackout from 1977, of why it occurred. I mean, under what circumstances such a massive blackout could and did occur.
Well, the blackout occurred on a very, as you said, a very hot evening. And so there's a lot of power was being drawn into the city to power people's air conditioners. And there was a massive storm that knocked out a series of power lines coming into the city. At that time, New York was importing most of its power, and these massive lightning strikes knocked out some lines. And soon, Con Ed, the utilities company, was struggling to get power into the city. And through a combination of technical problems and equipment failures, and also some bad decision making, the city shut down. They lost power at 9:30 at night, and everything went dark. So that's a technical thing of what happened. And then the experiences for people were very different. Some people, you know, were stuck in the city but had no idea that there was looting going on all around them. They were in restaurants or bars. It was kind of a convivial atmosphere for them. And they, it was, you know, decades before cell phones, and so people were kind of out of touch with neighborhoods that might only be a few blocks away.
So, in a sense, every person experienced this blackout according to where they happened to be. And in some neighborhoods, it was actually kind of a joyous, strange sort of slumber party kind of atmosphere. Neighbors helping neighbors and pitching in together and sort of making the best of an interesting situation. And of course, for other neighborhoods, essentially poor neighborhoods, in many cases, this turned into an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, it's interesting because New York had actually suffered a blackout 12 years earlier, 1965, another massive blackout that actually left 80 million people without power because it affected a large part of the Northeast.
So there was an even larger blackout, in other words.
Yes, it affected more people. But during that blackout, New Yorkers had behaved incredibly well, and that, you know, the stories of people directing traffic and helping each other out of buildings, and people on the subway who got stuck, that people, you know, there's a lot of kind of community spirit and no violence. And so when the blackout happened in 1977, I think everyone was kind of shocked at the reactions, some of the reactions. Within 10 minutes, there was looting across the five boroughs. 10 minutes of blackout. The lights went out around 9:30 at night, and massive looting across the city, destruction of stores. Some of these stores, you know, little stores run by small business owners. Some of them obviously weren't, but some small business owners lost everything. Hundreds of thousands of dollars of merchandise taken out of stores. Some looters went on to burn down the buildings that they'd looted. It was, widespread violence and chaos. And the police were taken aback too, because initially policemen were told to go to their local precinct, the precinct nearest where they lived, not to the one that they worked, but where they lived. And of course, that's not where the violence was happening. So it took a long time for the police to get to the looting and to try and try and stop it.
What did you know about this event before you began work on actually constructing, do we call it the screenplay or the script for this particular documentary? I mean, and on the other hand, how much did you have to learn about it as you set about preparing this program?
I have to confess, I knew very little about the story at all. I had vague memories of knowing that New York was a very different city in 1977 than it is today. And I think that's the thing that really you uncover in learning about this story, because understanding what was going on in New York helps to explain why there was so much violence. And, New York was at the sort of nadir of its existence in 1977. Very high crime rate, a lot of poverty, burned out, deserted inner city neighborhoods. The policing was, the police force was very overextended, very bad relationships between the community and police force. It was just a very bad time in the city. And I think people were very angry because what had happened, you know, New York had traditionally been a city that had really taken care of its population. It had a very good welfare system, free colleges, subsidized transportation, really good firefighting force and stellar police force. And then over the course of the late 60s and 70s, there had been really a population flight from the city, partly because industry had moved out of New York. There weren't the jobs. People went to the suburbs. There was a loss of almost a million people in population. And with those people goes the tax base. And so very high unemployment in the city. And in 1975, New York was really facing a default in its loans. It wasn't able to pay the loans that it had been borrowing heavily to pay its pay its bills, and it wasn't able to pay back those loans, and financiers were balking at lending the city any more money. And in the end, New York goes to the federal government, and the federal government agrees to help the city out, but under very stringent terms, and both the financial community and the federal government insist that New York institute these austerity measures. And so suddenly this city that had gone about looking after people is no longer able to. The police force is cut, the fire force is cut, welfare services are cut, the subway fares are increased. For the first time in almost 130 years, you had to pay tuition to go to city colleges. So it's really, I think people felt abandoned. There was no safe place for their kids to go after school. I think people felt abandoned, and there was incredible anger in the city.
So we're talking about a very emotionally raw moment in the history of the city, and in that respect, this blackout and the chaos which it kicked off could not have been more poorly timed. I wonder how much of this was known and thought about at the time. I know that part of your research and obviously part of the construction of this film involved the gathering of all kinds of first-person accounts and news accounts from when this event occurred. Was there very much sense of that context at the time, or is it only years later in retrospect that we sort of have come to a better understanding of just why this blackout kicked off this massive outpouring of anger and violence that it did?
Well, I think that, you know, the day afterwards, New Yorkers are looking around their city and thinking, oh my God, what has happened? There's something desperately wrong in New York that this kind of violence would happen, that we would do this to ourselves, to our neighbors. I mean, a lot of the people who looted had never done anything violent before, had never done anything criminal before. Many of them didn't have criminal records. So why would we see this? And I think there was an incredible amount of soul searching, and some people were disgusted and felt that there was a lot of racial animosity. There was a lot of finger pointing and blaming, and some New Yorkers felt like the looters were, they called them animals, and but I think it did provoke a lot of soul searching and thinking about why this would have happened. What had gone wrong in the city that people would do this to each other, to their neighbors, to the people who own the small store down the street? And you know, a lot of the store owners would say, you know, these were our customers. They recognized, they rushed to their stores in the middle of the night to try and protect them from the looting. And they realized that people coming in and breaking the windows and stealing their stuff were customers, people who lived in the neighborhood. So they were doing it to each other in a sense. And so I think there was an incredible amount of soul searching and trying to understand what had happened in the city. And I think that's what did happen in the years afterwards. People began to question themselves about what was wrong with the city. And, you know, New York's changed an incredible amount since that time, and in many ways. And I think part of it is there are all sorts of reasons why that would happen. But I do think that afterwards, people really were asking themselves, what's going on here?
We're speaking with Sharon Grimberg. We're talking about an American Experience documentary film airing tonight on PBS across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, a program called Blackout. It looks back at July 13th, 1977, when a massive power outage, a power blackout in New York City, darkened all five boroughs, leaving 7 million people without power. And in many of the poorest neighborhoods of the New York City metropolitan area, a absolutely savage wave of rioting, looting, violence, vandalism broke out, and leaving the city really just a shattered mess, as though one person in the film is quoted as saying it looked as though a bomb had gone off when finally daylight returned the next morning. A couple other follow-up questions, Sharon Grimberg. Without going into a whole lot of detail, I wonder if you could just say a word about sort of technically what went wrong, and parenthetically, I'm also curious, how much of a challenge was it for you in writing this script to sort of come to an understanding yourself about technically what went wrong and how best to sort of convey that? I think you do a great job in the film, but I suspect that wasn't a particularly easy matter.
Well, it's very complicated, and we ultimately, the film isn't so much about the technology of the power grid and the power system as it is about the sort of sociological and historical events and the fabric of the city. So in a very brief way, there were these lightning strikes that knocked out some power lines. And at the time, in 77, New York was importing most of its power from out of the city. That hadn't been the case a decade or more earlier, but for a variety of reasons, it was cheaper to import the power. And New York, because of clean air regulations, New York couldn't burn dirty coal in the city, and oil had become very expensive. So the power was mainly coming from outside the city. So there were these power, there were these lightning strikes on power lines. There were several strikes, a very, very big storm. And then the controller in of Con Ed was faced with how does he continue to generate sufficient power, because New York was needing a lot of power in this hot summer night. And he was faced with the choice of actually dropping some power, stopping, rather than allowing the lines to become overburdened and more lines be knocked out. The choice he faced was really, and he was being urged by other people in the system to drop load, to cut power to some small neighborhoods for a short period of time while he was able to restore the power so that other lines didn't get knocked out. And unfortunately, he wasn't able to do this. And at the time, people thought that it was his fault, that he didn't have the guts to drop power, to press the button. But actually, the system wasn't working in a way that he understood. And there were delays in having the power in the system that he didn't understand and other people didn't understand. So it actually wasn't technically his fault. And then there were other things that went wrong. So, for example, they could have generated more power in the city, but the workers in the plants where the generation could have happened had been allowed to go home, and so that couldn't happen. So there's a combination of errors that happened. And as somebody says in the film, you know, wasn't one thing. If any one of these things hadn't gone wrong, then the system wouldn't have gone down. But it was a combination of errors, both technical and sort of decision-making errors.
Right, and decisions which had to be made in the heat of the moment, both literally and figuratively, and sometimes it was probably impossible to make an entirely good decision. I mean, that sometimes the options were so very, very limited, and ultimately, of course, the situation deteriorated seriously. I don't know that you had anything to do with this particular matter, but one of the things that really helps heighten our sense of drama is that we hear sound recordings from what sound like phone calls, frantic phone calls between various power officials. Yeah. It's fascinating to me that those things exist, but I'm so glad they do, because it really takes us back to the drama of that night.
Yes, no, I think that people were frantic because they could see that the whole city was going to go down, and they were yelling at this poor guy in the control room and saying, you know, you've got to drop load, you've got to do it right now. If you don't do it right now, the system's going to go down. I mean, people were... And it's all in these recordings.
It's just fascinating. As the power goes out, of course, we're taken to various locales, including in what's really quite poignant, of course, we're taken to the 107th floor of one of the World Trade Center towers and to a restaurant there. And, of course, we hear about the experience of those patrons up in that restaurant who suddenly find themselves essentially stranded that far from the ground. And it underscores a point that's made in the narration about New York City being very much a vertical city, a city full of skyscrapers. And in a situation like this, where suddenly there is no power, that can be a very, very serious situation indeed when a power outage happens in a so-called vertical city.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons people are so frantic. If the power goes out in the suburb, the stakes are lower in a sense. People aren't going to get stuck in elevators. You know, to get water up to the top of these buildings, you have to have pumps that run on electricity. Old people are stuck. You know, you can't walk down 20 flights of stairs or up 20 flights of stairs. So the stakes are higher in a vertical city, and they knew that. Con Ed knows that mm-hmm. it's people's lives are more endangered in that situation.
A very, very good point that's made about the violence which erupts is the fact that it happened in a sense in two waves. Not to oversimplify the matter, but the fact is that there were, generally speaking at least, one kind of looter doing looting in the immediate wake of the power outage. I mean, within just a very few minutes, I mean, almost instantly. And then there was, in a sense, a second wave of looters and looting. And almost entirely, it was those looters who ended up being arrested. I think that's a fascinating observation. I'm so glad that you make that point so clearly. Explain to our listeners about that, about the two waves of looting, the distinction between them, and why it was only the second wave of looters who tended to be arrested.
So, you know, when the power goes out, the first people who go and break windows and pull off the gates of closed up stores, they're criminals. They're hardened criminals. They've done this before. They have rap sheets, and you know they've been arrested before. And they go in quickly and they take things. Some people even bring trucks and load stuff onto trucks. And there's this amazing story about Ace Pontiac in the Bronx, where 200 people came crashing through the gates and drove off with 55. Brand new cars. So the first wave is the criminals who go in. And then as the night goes on, you know, you have these regular people sitting in their really hot, stuffy apartments or outside because it's such a hot day and there's night and there's no air conditioning or fans or anything. And they see people walking away with stuff. And these are people, a lot of these people are really hard up. And they think, you know, I should just go to the supermarket and get me some steaks, or I'll go and get diapers. I mean, apparently the diapers were cleaned out of the city. There wasn't a set of diapers to be found in a store after this, because diapers were expensive and people went and stole diapers. And so the people who went in the second wave were not criminals, but they felt like, you know what, everyone's doing it. I could use some diapers. I could use, I'll get my family a really nice dinner tonight, tomorrow night. And so they just went and took stuff. And of course, these people, it took them several hours to make this decision. And they went later. And by the time they went into the stores, the police were there. And so the first wave went in, the criminals went in before the police were able to get to the looted areas. And the second wave, you know, they just were unfortunately there when the police were there. And most of them had never done anything wrong in their lives and never been caught doing anything wrong.
Mm. And, of course, we see absolutely staggering images of not only the looting as it takes place, but also the aftermath. I mean, what the city looks like that next morning. It's absolutely incredible. It's a horrifying sight in so many ways. You've already touched on the fact that really in the immediate wake of this incident and in the days and weeks and months and years to follow, a great deal of reflection and soul searching went on about just what happened, and not just why did the power go out, but why did so many people react to it the way that they did. I wonder to what extent you think this event played a significant role in the spectacular renaissance that New York City has experienced in recent years. To what extent Was this a significant catalyst in that process?
You know, I think it's hard to trace any, you know, any change in a city to one particular event. But I do think that the looting and the blackout were kind of a wake-up call and a moment to reflect. And I do think that the blackout and the looting did play a big role in the mayoral race, which was, you know, it was a election year, and Abe Beame, who was the mayor of New York, was running. It was a very crowded Democratic field, and he was running against many opponents. And Ed Koch, who became mayor that year, I think he did talk a lot about how the city had been run and the kind of official response to the blackout and the looting. He didn't make hay with it in the election campaign, and you know, he was a very different kind of mayor than Abe Beame had been. So I don't know how much. There are all sorts of forces that played into what happened over the next 20 years. I think that the blackout kind of epitomized the kind of depths to which New York had fallen in the 70s, and it's really a window onto that moment and made people really reflect on the city, and it did play a big role, I think, in that mayoral election.
Well, it is a fascinating film. It is so powerful, and I am really anxious for many people to view it and to learn so much from it as I did. Before I let you go, I think I read in your biography that you are hard at work on a documentary film about Joseph McCarthy. Do I remember that correctly?
I'm developing it, yes. I'm developing a project about Joseph McCarthy.
I'm only asking because, of course, our station is located in Wisconsin, so
yes,
we know that name especially well.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting time to take a look at him again. I think there's been a lot of recent sort of knowledge that wasn't available 20, 25 years ago about the communist in America, about the Soviet Union, because of the opening of the Soviet archives in the 1990s, and also the availability of Venona cables. And so there's a lot of new resources in which to reevaluate his career and his and the impact he had on America.
Hmm. Well, we await the completion of that project with great interest, again, particularly here in Wisconsin,
yes,
the state
yes,
which from which he comes. But in the meantime, we want to urge people again to watch the American Experience film called Blackout, airing tonight on PBS on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country. And it is a film very much worth watching and reflecting upon. Sharon Grimberg, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with one of the country's most talented and successful writers, Steve Barry. You may know that name from a number of best-selling novels that he has written, I think 9 or 10 by now, around the figure of Cotton Malone, and several other novels as well. He's extremely successful. And this latest novel, yet another in the Cotton Malone series, is called The Patriot Threat. And like most of Steve Barry's works, it is rooted in American history. In this particular case, rooted in a reality that involves the laws that brought into being our income tax and the possibility that if indeed that legislation was somehow fatally flawed, and in fact there is no reason for us to have income tax, think of what a secret, what a powerful secret that could be in the hands of someone who, in a sense, wanted to disable the United States in a fiduciary fashion. That's just one ingredient in this really thrilling novel by Steve Barry. which, by the way, is in a sense kind of a book within a book. And we'll explain that in just a moment. The book is published by Minotaur Books. Again, it's called The Patriot Threat. And Steve Barry, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Talk for a moment about this genre in which you are working, that this is not just a novel, but a novel that is, and not just a thriller, but a thriller that is based in history with some intriguing historical facts that are woven into the mix. Talk a moment about this interesting niche in which you like to write.
Yeah, I like to take something from the past, something forgotten, something you may not know anything about, and get you to learn more about it. And that's the hook that I go through. That's the hook as I put it together. And in this case, it was something that happened 100 years ago with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, something that's real, that really did happen. The Solicitor General at the time warned the Secretary of State that there was problems in the ratification process. He told the Secretary of State to move with caution here, but the Secretary of State ignored that advice and declared the 16th Amendment in effect. He didn't declare it ratified, which is very interesting. He said in effect. And the amendment took over. About 20 years ago, someone went behind that to find out what the Solicitor General was actually upset about and discovered something quite shocking. In nearly all 42 states that considered the amendment, there were problems. In 15 of the states, there were problems so severe that they most likely did not even ratify the amendment. You only have to void six states to void the amendment. And so it's just this fascinating thing that happened so long ago that could have catastrophic consequences today. So I wove this thriller using this as a weapon against us.
Let's talk for a moment about the title character, but the central character in the novel, for the sake of any of our listeners who are not familiar with who Cotton Malone is.
Yeah, he's a retired Justice Department agent. He lives in Copenhagen. He runs an old bookshop and kind of stays in trouble all the time. He's had 10 adventures now. I don't write them, though, where you have to read them in order or anything. You can read them in any order you want, and I write them almost like standalones in some respects. And so he's been around a little while, and now he gets caught up in this constitutional crisis. And it's for the first time I was able to do the whole thriller in 23 hours. So everything happens in this book really fast. And the reader is going to find out some cool stuff about Franklin Roosevelt and Andrew Mellon and the $1 bill and a painting that hangs in the National Gallery of Art. It's there in Gallery 62. A man named Hyman Solomon, who helped finance the American Revolution. All of this is going to be woven around this constitutional crisis that Cotton gets caught up in.
And, of course, because it's a thriller, just about everything that happens is cloaked in a deep veil of secrecy. One of the dynamics that is especially interesting in the book, and I should think to at least some extent very true to life, is the fact that we have, in a sense, different government agencies not fully cooperating with each other. In many cases, not cooperating at all.
No, and
being very possessive of the secrets which each of them sort of hold in their pocket. And for understandable reasons to a point, but we're also sort of painted this very vivid picture of how that can really undermine their own respective efforts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're trying to keep your own little secrets in your own little niche. But unfortunately, they're spilling over, and that's part of the novel illustrates that, of how this happens. Treasury Department has a secret in which they don't want anyone else to know. And unfortunately, you know, it gets out, and once it gets out, then it becomes just a disaster across the board, and, you know, everyone's trying to plug this leak as this leak gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, That's part of what I wanted to illustrate somewhat, was the how the left hand and the right hand sometimes in the intelligence business has no idea what they're doing. And in this case, it could have catastrophic consequences because of what's happening out there. I have a rogue North Korean. I was fascinated with North Korea. This is an interesting country I know almost nothing about. And I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted the reader to know more about it. But, you know, really, North Korea can't hurt us. It's more a nuisance than anything else. It's not really anything that causes us any serious harm unless they could get a hold of something that they could use our own laws against us. They could turn our own rules against us. And that's what this rogue North Korean is after. He's after his birthright, and he's going to take America down. And I modeled him after a real guy. The actual leader of North Korea right now was not supposed to be the leader of North Korea. His older brother was supposed to have that job. But his older brother tried to take one of his children and sneak into Japan to go to Disneyland. He got caught, and he embarrassed his father, and his father stripped him of his birthright. And that's why we have the leader we have now. And that older brother still lives in Macau and is still alive, so I loosely based my antagonist on what happened to him.
Mm. And, of course, one of the things that makes him a dangerous figure is because he is widely viewed as shallow and directionless and so on. And, in fact, he is a very, very smart man and a very dangerous man because everybody around him so seriously underestimates him.
That's the whole point. And he likes that. He likes to be underestimated, and he works under the radar. And now he's at the point where he's about to pull this off. Unfortunately for him, Cotton Malone gets in the middle of it, and that's where the thriller aspect of all this comes in. But there's a lot of real things in the book. I try to keep my books about 90% to reality. I only trip it up about 10% of the time for the entertainment value. And I have a writer's note in the back, though, that tells you where I trip you up.
Mm. And in other words, it really spells out the whole matter of fact versus fiction.
Yes, and I want you to know that. I don't want you to leave the book thinking something is real and it's not. It's usually the other way around. You're going to think something's false, and you're going to discover that it's real because, as I said, I keep the book about 90% close to reality.
Hmm. We're speaking with Steve Barry about his latest novel, which is called The Patriot Threat. It's one of a number of books which he has written, thrillers involving a figure called Cotton Malone, once an elite intelligence division officer within the Justice Department, and now on his own in semi-retirement, but pulled out of semi-retirement again and again. In fact, talk about the small elite group which he now is affiliated with.
Yeah, I created the Magellan Billet. It was just something I made up one day because I thought, well, why don't the Justice Department have something that can work for the Attorney General and do what needs to be done in a covert way? So I created this concept of the Magellan Billet. Cotton retired out a few years ago, and he moved to Copenhagen, and he runs that old bookshop, but he just can't help it. He just gets keep drawing back in, and I transitioned Cotton a little bit for a while. He was drawn back in because of things happening to his friends and family, and those kind of things, these personal reasons to bring him back in, but, you know, after a while, you kind of run out of those, so he's kind of transitioned now into an agent for hire, and he kind of gets hired back in, and for what he thinks is one thing, which quickly becomes something else, and that's what happens here. A simple little meet and greet recon mission turns into this big 23-hour adventure that he has to, you know, go across Venice and Croatia to deal with, while my other character, Stephanie Nell, who heads the Magellan Billet, is in Washington, D.C., dealing with that aspect of it. And all of this is happening simultaneously as this constitutional crisis begins to unravel.
Talk for a moment about constructing a thriller that plays out on several stages simultaneously and stages that are all over the world. I'm really impressed at the clarity with which this novel unfolds, for as complicated as the story in fact is and how tightly packed that story is.
Thank you. I work hard on that because you've got to make sure that what's happening in one side of the world has relevance to what's happening on the other side of the world. And it only has relevance in the reader's mind because the reader is actually privileged to both worlds. And so they're parallel, but they are somewhat intertwined with one another and interconnected. And that's what makes them work, is that interconnection. And I keep that connection going until eventually these two worlds hit up to each other and butt up to each other. Now, in this case, they only butt up to each other from the standpoint of the plot. They still stay separated and from one side of the globe to the other. But I have to be careful to keep them as close to one another as I can in the reader's mind. Otherwise, you'll get confused. And, you know, this time I thought I kept them pretty tight.
Hmm. So you, as you have already talked about, are utilizing a couple of people from our own history who really lived.
Yeah.
And one of them was this man by the name of Chaim Salomon.
Chaim Salomon, yeah.
You call him in the writer's note one of the unsung heroes of the American Revolution.
No question.
Tell us why we should know his name and how you utilize his legacy in this novel.
Well, we should know him very much so, because he's the man who financed the American Revolution. You can't run a war without money. And he's the guy that found the money to keep the revolution going. And he also loaned the country $800,000 of his own money that kept the country going. And Washington was so appreciative of what Haiman Solomon did that he asked him, what would you like as a thank you? Solomon says, I don't want anything for me, but I'd like something for my community. And he was Jewish. So Washington said, okay, fine, this is what I'll do. On the Great Seal of the United States, above the eagle, on the back of the $1 bill, you can see the Great Seal. Above the eagle are 13 stars. And those stars supposedly were arranged to form a perfect Star of David in appreciation to Haiman Solomon. Solomon died in 1785. He never actually saw the country formed. Five times Congress has considered repayment of the money we owe Solomon. Five times Congress has said no. That debt today would be worth somewhere around $300 billion, and we've never paid him back. So to me, Solomon is as much a founding father as any of the others that we recognize.
Right. And, of course, one of the contentions of your novel is that if there were somehow proof, evidently proof that, in fact, ultimately disappeared, that such a debt, in fact, was owed,
yeah.
If proof of that could be somehow recovered or rediscovered, it would put the United States in a very uncomfortable position.
Very much so, an embarrassing position, too. What happened was the documentation for the notes that were owed to Solomon were turned over to the Pennsylvania treasurer in right after his death in 1785, and that documentation just vanished. It just disappeared. And that's how Congress has refused to pay the debts back, because they say we don't have any proof that we owe him any money. Even though history says we do, they don't have any documentary proof of it.
How about the figure of Andrew Mellon? I suspect a real student of American history might know who Mr. Mellon was, but many Americans would probably have no notion or only the vaguest notion.
Richest, most powerful man in America in the 1920s. Served as Secretary of Treasury for 11 years across three different presidents, which, by the way, is a tough thing to do. I hypothesized in the novel how he managed to pull that off. Franklin Roosevelt hated him, and Mellon hated Roosevelt. They had a blood feud between them. Roosevelt hated him so bad that he had him indicted for tax evasion. Mellon beat the charge, but these two men just went at it, and finally they met face-to-face on December 31st, 1936 in the White House, and that is the prologue of the novel, when these two people finally come together, and that's where the National Gallery of Art was born. I just added another element to their feud to make it even deeper and more intense, and that forms the basis of the Patriot threat. But it was fascinating to study Mellon because he was such a powerful man behind the scenes, and he was so wealthy. And he's one of those guys we don't know a whole lot about, but we need to.
We've already touched on what in many respects is kind of the central matter here, the controversy which surrounds the creation and the ratification of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, which of course is why all of us pay income taxes. And question has been drawn up about that process by which that ratification took place. When you kind of outline some of this in the writer's note, you say that whether these charges or concerns are in fact fully true, you leave that to the reader to determine. I think what you're saying there is you're not insisting that they're absolutely truthful, but if they're true, they make for fascinating grist for a novel.
There you go. Yeah, this is not a manifesto for not paying your taxes. We all got to pay our taxes. And it's a novel which by definition is not real. What it is, though, is bringing to your attention something that happened 100 years ago, something that is true, that really did happen, something that has some fascinating implications and some just interesting aspects to it. And hopefully the reader will want to learn a little bit more about that and take a look at some of that. I've done several books now with the Constitution and some of these constitutional quirks. I'm fascinated by the flaws and quirks in our Constitution. And I've explored two or three of those, and I've still got a couple of more to go. And this is one that just I came across, and I just couldn't resist. It just, as I said, made for a really good thriller.
Right. And, of course, I think for a lot of us living in modern America, we are intrigued by the notion that documents from over a century ago or a transaction which occurred more than 200 years ago could have such direct relevance to us today.
That's right. That's all of my books deal with that. Something that's something from the past that's still relevant today. That's the what I call the so what. You know, who cares if the 16th Amendment wasn't ratified properly? Well, okay, I'll show you why we care in a so what. Someone could use that as a weapon against us. Since, as I said, the government derives 90% of its revenues from income tax, what if they were able to avoid that and turn our own laws against us? It's like, as one of the characters in the book says, it's the cleverest weapon of mass destruction ever.
The book, again, is called The Patriot Threat, and it's published by Minotaur Books. It's the latest Cotton Malone novel by Steve Barry. Steve Barry, a great pleasure for me to speak with you on The Morning Show about your very exciting newest book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, sir.
Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago. He later served as station manager, and he was one of the hosts of the WGTD Morning Show. Eight fifty-seven on this Tuesday, July the 14th. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming coming up at 9 o'clock. Between now and then, we can give you the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Listen, if you're planning to head out to one of the beaches in Lake Michigan, you might want to rethink it. The National Weather Service has a beach hazard statement in effect from this afternoon through tonight. Just want to give you a heads up on that. The forecast today, a partly sunny morning, then a cloudy afternoon, 30% chance of rain, today's high 79. Perspective on that number, normal high this time of year would be 80 degrees, so we're pretty much on target there. The record high, incidentally, we hit 102 degrees, July the 14th, 1995. Tonight, a clear sky, mild conditions, a low of 59. Tomorrow, Wednesday, sunny and 77 degrees. Looking ahead for the rest of the week, Thursday, partly sunny, 30% chance of rain. Thursday's high, 76. Going to be a hot one on Friday, partly sunny and hot. Again, 30% chance of rain. Friday's high, 87. Saturday and Sunday, partly sunny and hot. Chance of rain both days. Temperatures in the upper 80s, both Saturday and Sunday. And then come Monday, a 50-50 chance of rain with a high of 82. Brand new numbers are in, 71 degrees in Kenosha, 74 for Racine. It is 70 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, 73 degrees in Milwaukee. Still a bit sticky this morning, 84% the humidity, wind from the west at 10. Coming up on 8:59, this is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. The news is next from NPR at 9 o'clock, and then classical music programming from Wisconsin Public Radio.